Well, thanks so much for joining me today for episode number 3 of season 2 of the Healthy Skeptic MD podcast. I'm Dr. Michael Hochman. This season, we are focused on key common medical decisions that many of us will need to consider at one point or another in our lives, either directly for ourselves or for a close friend or family member. So far this season, we have talked about the pros and cons of a daily statin cholesterol medication to lower cardiovascular risk. That was with Dr. Rita Redberg from the University of California, San Francisco. Last week, we talked about whether or not routine annual labs are really necessary with Dr. Stephen Hochman, a primary care doctor who also happens to be my brother. We have a number of great other key medical decisions to cover in the weeks ahead. And today we are going to hone in on tonsillectomies and ear tube placements in children. These are two of the most common surgical procedures in any age group. We're very lucky to be joined by Dr. Nina Shapiro, an ENT pediatric surgeon at UCLA. Nina is well regarded in her field, very well respected, and also a very successful author and media expert who's widely quoted on health topics. This is a great episode to pass along to any friends or family members who have young children who have frequent ear infections, fluid behind the ears, or sleeping issues. So please do stick around. Dr. Shapiro's discussion is great. If you do find this discussion engaging, if it helps you get more thoughtful about your health, please do search and subscribe to the Healthy Skeptic MD. Wherever you listen to podcasts or on YouTube, please do consider leaving a review if you have a chance and pass it along to friends or family members. It really does help to get the word out there about the podcast. Okay, so before we jump into our interview with Nina Shapiro today, just a quick couple health news headlines to make note of. The first was an article in The Counter describing the really alarming rate in the rise in obesity among children. At baseline, 19% of American children are obese, which is very high to start with. And many public health experts and pediatricians are concerned that this is going to increase to as high as 23 to 25%. So almost one out of every four children could be obese, which is really a startling number. The article also describes how important the in-person school environment is for healthy lifestyles, recess time, gym class, being around other kids makes helps kids be more physically active. And although school lunches are not known to be the most nutritious, in many cases are actually better than the food that children are eating at home. And also during the pandemic, many school districts have been distributing lunches, but these are often processed foods and not as good as the standard school lunches. So this is yet another downside of the closures that we've experienced as the pandemic, and really highlights the need about how important it is to get schools safely reopened as soon as possible, as we've discussed in previous episodes. In addition, this week, there were new federal tobacco guidelines that were released about the main thrust was that it's really important for us doctors to be constantly reminding our patients to cut back on cigarettes, quit, and give them options to help support them. But what was most notable to me, and I think is most newsworthy, it was the first time that a major body commented on e-cigarettes. And the panel concluded that it was uncertain the pros and the cons of using e-cigarettes to help people quit smoking. And the reason for this is that although e-cigarettes have been shown in studies to be very effective in helping transition people off traditional cigarettes, after a year, the vast majority, 80%+ of people are still using these e-cigarettes. So really important topic, because if e-cigarettes could help people be healthier and get off cigarettes, that would be a great thing. But many of us have a lot of concerns about the long-term consequences of e-cigarettes. So slowly but surely, we're starting to accumulate some data on this question. So finally today, I would like to make note of a new New England Journal of Medicine study looking at medications to help people quit methamphetamine abuse, which is, as many people know, a real growing problem and challenge in the United States right now. So they examined the use of bupropion and naltrexone, two medications to help people. These medications have been used effectively for other addiction disorders. And according to the New England Journal article, after 12 weeks with these medications, unfortunately, more than 85% of patients were still using large quantities of methamphetamine However, on the positive side, abstinence rates were slightly but significantly higher with the benefit of these medications. So it does seem that there is some benefit of these medications, but it is small. This is encouraging. We may now have a somewhat effective treatment for this really challenging addiction disorder, but clearly there's a lot more work that needs to be done because this medication is definitely not a panacea. So with that, let's jump into our interview with Dr. Nina Shapiro. Well, welcome to the Healthy Skeptic MD, Dr. Nina Shapiro.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here today, Nina. I first met you or heard about you when my wife did a rotation as a medical student. I was so impressed with your practice and thought you were such a great doctor, and we've worked together subsequently, so I'm really happy to have you today. And along those lines, maybe before we get into our discussion, you could just tell the audience a little bit about your practice.
Sure. So I am a pediatric ENT or otolaryngologist at UCLA. I've been there for a little over two decades, and my practice is very focused. Obviously, it's just children. ENT problems in children. And I tend to focus on airway issues, newborn airway issues, as well as any sort of breathing problems throughout childhood. Obviously, I see a lot of ear problems as well, sinus problems, head and neck masses. So really the gamut of pediatric ENT, because it's UCLA, we are a tertiary quaternary care center. So we do see a lot of healthy kids with minor ENT problems, but we also see a lot of critically ill and chronically ill kids with problems related to ENT as well.
Sounds good. Well, in addition to being a doctor, you have written at least three books that I'm aware of, and you're frequently on the media, on the doctors, and getting quoted frequently in the media. Your most recent book was called Hype. Can you tell us a little bit about that book and the points you were trying to convey with that?
Sure. So Hype was written really out of my experiences not only as a physician, but also as a person, as a mom, as a friend, just hearing about a lot of people's health concerns. And I felt that a lot of people had really, really good questions, but a lot of people's decisions were misguided and based on misinformation that they were hearing, whether it was from other friends or social media. And I felt it was really important to write a book to address all of these issues that we all question, you know, questions about our diet, nutrition, vaccines, exercise, reading things on the internet, really how to navigate that on a daily basis, because you know now information comes so quickly. So how do we really know what's true and what's false or what's hype? You know, there's always somewhere in the middle, but oftentimes, you know, there's a sweet spot that we need to get to.
Well, it's a great book. There's really interesting examples, but it also gives a great framework for how to think about a medical claim and whether it's something that's believable or not. So I really would encourage everyone to consider getting it on Amazon or wherever it is that you get books. Well, I'd be remiss, Nina, if I didn't also mention the book that you and I have worked on together called 50 Studies Every Pediatrician Should Know. This one targets a medical audience, not a lay audience. But the theme is evidence-based medicine. We distill some of the most important landmark studies. And I think the audience might be interested in hearing what is evidence-based medicine? Why do you think it's important?
So yeah, so first of all, that was a great experience. And I joined onto that group of primarily pediatricians, actually. And I was really privileged to work with so many great people, including yourself. And it is a great series besides just the pediatric volume. So that's been a lot of fun. And so what we really focus on in 50 studies, and just when we think about evidence-based medicine, is when we make medical decisions, clinical decisions for our patients, it shouldn't just be based on, well, this is how we do it, and this is and we will continue to do it because this is how we do it. It has to be based on some really solid data.
I think we all want our doctors, you know, making decisions not based on anecdotal experiences, but on what actually rigorous, large data tells us. Now, you've another topic that you've written a lot and spoken a lot about are vaccines. Vaccines get a lot of scrutiny. I think you probably believe that, you know, we all should be skeptical and scrutinize vaccines, but you've made the case, and I certainly agree with you, that there's been maybe over scrutiny of vaccines, which has led to people not getting vaccines that really help, like MMR vaccines and disease outbreaks that are unnecessary. Why do you think it is the vaccines get so much scrutiny and so much heat?
You know, it's a good question. I think that vaccines are scary for a lot of people, and for good reason. You know, here you have a healthy child and they don't have any of these vaccine preventable diseases. You've never heard of most of them. You've never seen any of them. So why subject your infant or child to a medication, an injection that may cause problems? And, you know, we need to be very clear that vaccines are not without risk. And thankfully, those risks are usually extremely mild, and the rare severe risks are extraordinarily rare. But, you know, I think there's a little bit of concern and fear, and rightly so, that parents have as far as giving something to a child that is otherwise healthy, that's not necessarily going to be exposed to these vaccine-preventable illnesses. Why subject them to that? So I think that's one of the reasons. And I think the other reason is the notion that they have to, that they're mandated. And that's a tricky subject when it's your child's body, your own body. How can some outside agency foist this on your family? So I think, you know, for that reason, there's a lot of concern and a lot of skepticism. And there have been problems, and vaccines are not perfect. They don't work perfectly, meaning they don't necessarily protect everybody 100%. And they do have some risks and some side effects. I think the studies that were very falsely done and erroneously done and gave the incorrect information really has done some serious damage to our society, notably the Wakefield study, where he forged the data and the study was eventually pulled. But despite that, he still has a voice saying that vaccines are unnecessary and that they're dangerous. And I think people really sort of cling to that piece of information and will hold on to that and not necessarily look at this evidence-based data of thousands and thousands of children over many years who've had success from these vaccines.
Yeah, well, I think it's that balance, as you said, of being skeptical, not giving something to a healthy person that could cause serious harms. But if we have data from tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people showing it's safe and it prevents really serious illnesses, these mandates do make sense for certain vaccines like MMR and in schools. Well, along those lines, what's your take so far on the COVID vaccine, which we obviously don't have as much data as we do for these other childhood vaccines, but what's your impression so far?
So I have been vaccinated with the COVID vaccine, with the Pfizer-BioNTech, and I have no conflict of interest with the company. And I feel very fortunate and relieved that I was able to be vaccinated so early. And, you know, what I've learned about this the vaccines that are approved, so that's the Moderna and the Pfizer at this point, is that they're very similar. They're not identical vaccines, but they are mRNA vaccines, which are very, very safe and are also very, very short-lived, meaning that they don't hang around in the body for too long once they do their job. The ingredients are very simple. There's no preservatives, you know, all the things that we've been worried about in the past, such as formaldehyde, mercury, those are not contained in these vaccines. You know, one of the things everybody's been hearing about is that they only last a few hours once they're out of that freezer, whether it's really, really cold or just sort of cold. And, you know, I think that should give some comfort to note that there's not preservatives. They're not sitting on the shelf for weeks and weeks, that they only last a short time. So the success from the studies, and they did look at, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of individuals ages 16 plus for Pfizer and 18 plus for Moderna, is that they are working and the volunteers are being followed. It's been nearly a year now that they've been tested, I think about 9 or 10 months. So they'll continue to be followed. And they still have antibodies. So what we don't know is how long the vaccines will provide immunity. But what I've heard, early estimates are anywhere from 1 to 3 years. So that's certainly very encouraging.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be interesting to follow, and I think we're going to need to follow the data, as you said, to make sure we're making evidence-based decisions. Now, we're both in Los Angeles. The superintendent of the LA schools recently said that he plans to mandate the COVID-19 vaccine for children. That actually caught me by surprise a little bit because it hasn't been FDA approved actually for anyone yet. It's just an emergency use authorization, let alone for children. And it really hasn't been studied extensively yet for children. But what's your take? Am I being too critical of him for this?
You are not. I think, you know, he spoke a little bit too soon. I think, you know, he really wants people to get back to school. And I think he frankly said this not realizing what he was saying, because it will not be approved by the fall for children. And they're just sort of in the middle of studies for children ages 12 to 15 or 12 to 17. And, you know, that data is probably going to take another 6 months or so. And they're still recruiting volunteers for those studies. So to say that all children are going to need to be vaccinated is an impossibility at this point, you know, certainly not for the fall of 2021. It's not even the studies in children ages 5 to 12 haven't even been considered yet. I think it's going to be interesting as far as teachers and staff. So should teachers and staff be required to be vaccinated? That's a big question that I think needs to be addressed, because there will be teachers and there will be staff members of schools that do not want this vaccine. And should they be allowed to be exposing themselves to children in the classroom, even with masks, even with all the protection? I think that will be an issue that will come up in some schools.
Yeah, it is an interesting point about teachers. Based on our healthcare experience at USC, the Keck Health System, for example, I think we're at about 70% of our healthcare workers have been vaccinated, but there are still that 30% that are not voluntarily getting vaccines. Some of them may be for good reasons if they have history of severe allergies. So that is going to be an interesting question. How hard do we push to get those last 20 to 30% of teachers. Good. I ultimately, I do hope the vaccine will prove safe in kids, and I will be very happy to give it to them at that point. But I'm not quite ready to do so based on the data we have so far.
No, I agree. Yeah.
So let's shift gears. I've been focusing this season of The Healthy Skeptic on common medical decisions that we all should be aware of. And in children, some of the most common big procedures, at least for kids, these are bigger procedures that need to happen or that come up, are related to tonsils, tonsillectomy, and also ear tubes for those with recurrent ear infections. And so I thought you'd be a great person to help talk us through these topics. Let's start with ear tubes. Can you just tell us a little bit about the procedure? Why would you put in ear tubes in somebody? What do you do with the procedure? Just start with the basics.
Sure. So ear tubes are the most common surgical procedure in children, hands down. And it is a very life-changing procedure when it's done for the right reasons. And what we do is typically a child, if they're having ear tubes as the sole procedure, they are placed under general anesthesia, but just with a mask. So we don't even usually have an IV placed at the time. And they are completely asleep for about 5 to 10 minutes. And we look at their eardrums under the microscope. We make a tiny little opening in the eardrum, about a millimeter in size, so a little bit bigger than a pinhole. If there's fluid at the time, we drain it out. And then we insert a little plastic tube. Usually it's plastic, occasionally it's metal, but typically it's plastic. It's about 1.2 millimeters, and it looks like a little spool or a little button, and it sits in the eardrum opening that we made, sort of like a button in a buttonhole. And what that does is it creates a mature drainage system for the child who was unable to drain fluid. And it sits in the eardrum. They don't usually feel it afterwards. And typically they go home about 30 minutes after the procedure. If they were in in-person school, they would go to school the next day. It's a really quick recovery. Some kids need some acetaminophen or ibuprofen that afternoon, usually not. And then we see the kids in follow-up. Typically, the tubes stay in for about a year That's the most common. And then they fall out. The eardrum sort of rejects it and pushes it out over the following 12 to 18 months.
And when a child comes to you with recurrent ear infections or fluid behind the ears and some hearing difficulties, what factors do you consider whether it makes sense to proceed with an invasive procedure like this?
So there are a lot of things to consider, and we'll talk about some of the studies as well, I know. But, you know, there are a lot of things to consider. One is the age of the child. In general, this is a problem we see primarily in children ages 3 years and younger. Occasionally, we'll see older children, so we take those factors into account as well. You know, for instance, if a seven-year-old with recurrent otitis media, that's a little bit of a different situation than a two-and-a-half-year-old. How many times they've been infected, whether or not these infections clear, either on their own or with antibiotics, whether the child is needing additional antibiotics. So for instance, a child who does not respond to oral antibiotics, where they need intramuscular antibiotics or even IV antibiotics, if they're having hearing, and not only hearing issues, but speech issues related to chronic fluid. And also sometimes we consider, even in Los Angeles, the time of year. So, you know, for instance, if I'm seeing a child towards the end of our winter, because we do have a little bit of a winter and a cold season typically, and their ear infections are starting to taper out, it's a little more likely that their ear infections will subside in the spring months.
How does age influence your decision? Would you be more or less likely in younger children to place ear tubes?
So in older children, so for instance, a 5 or a 7-year-old, which is, you know, after age 3 or 4, it just gets less and less common for children to have recurrent infections. The older children are more likely to clear on their own. So for them, if they're not having any difficulties in school or speech issues specifically related to fluid and hearing loss, and they do respond either to time or antibiotics, depending on the situation, they may clear on their own much more likely than a toddler, where the fluid is much more likely to linger and just get stuck behind, you know, in the middle ear.
Okay, so if I were a parent with a child in this situation, I'd want to know a lot about the risks of the procedure. What can go wrong with ear tube placement?
So it is, you know, as I tell parents, you know, no procedure is without risk. You know, but at the same time, not doing the procedure also carries some risks. But what are the risks of the procedure itself? So the first thing, and most concerning for most parents, is the anesthesia itself. And thankfully, children are much healthier than adults, so they tend to tolerate anesthesia much better than adults do. So, you know, we can see some nausea and vomiting and some other sort of reactions to anesthesia. A lot of kids, over 50%, have a little emergence delirium. So some temporary dysphoria where they wake up and it's almost like they're having a night terror. And that's 50%. So that's a lot of children that we see that in. And but otherwise, the anesthesia is very safe. The risks of ear tubes themselves, theoretically, you know, if your hand is unstable, you can nick, you know, the ear canal or you know, deeper into the middle ear. That's really just surgical mishaps. And you know, the other problems that we see are more long term. So for instance, the tubes stay in too long. You place the tubes and then here you are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, and the tube has still stayed in the eardrum. We call that a retained tympanostomy tube. So that's a little bit of a nuisance when that happens. And then the other problem is the tube can fall out too soon. So you place the tube and the patient comes in for their follow-up and the tube has already fallen out 4 weeks later.
Do any of these complications, can any of them lead to long-term hearing loss?
So the hearing loss itself from a tube is usually going to be conductive. So from the eardrum itself or from the middle ear space, or even if there's an ear bone issue, any sort of sensory neural loss would be only related to a severe ear infection. So, you know, influenza or, you know, some strange viral or even bacterial extension. But from the tube itself, that wouldn't cause any sort of, you know, chronic sensory neural hearing loss.
So the nerve would remain intact. There might be some blockage or scarring that could interfere with hearing on the way in. And so, but what you're saying is if it's the right child who's selected, the risks of not having the tube are going to outweigh those risks.
Right.
So we talked before about evidence-based medicine, and this has been, as you mentioned, one of the most common surgical procedures. So we do have some good data on it. There was a pediatrician, Dr. Jack Paradise, at the University of Pittsburgh, who's sort of the godfather of research in this field. And he did a famous series of studies looking at the outcomes with ear tubes. Now, one of the big reasons you place them is you don't want kids to have hearing problems and fall behind in schools. And what he found in his study is that although ear tubes, help clear up ear infections a little faster, they get the fluid out, they don't consistently, at least in the patients he studied, lead to improvements or improvements in learning outcomes among children. So what's your take on that study?
So this was a landmark study for every pediatric otolaryngologist on the planet. And at the time, I was working with someone in Boston, and they were you know, calling their friend Jack Paradise and yelling at him that how could he ruin us? But you know, there's really good data in that study. He looked at over 400 children for a few years, then he extended it, and then he extended it again. So he really followed these infants and toddlers. The extended studies were through fourth or fifth grade. So, and what he found was, and if you read between the lines a little bit, what he looked at is whether early tympanostomy tube placement improved their speech outcomes later on, but it didn't mean that the other group did not have tubes at all. So the different groups were children who had tubes within 3 months of their evaluation versus children who had tubes 6 or 9 months later. So all of the children ended up getting tubes at some point, but it was just whether you needed to rush it and whether rushing it was going to impact their long-term outcomes. And what he found was that they did not. So, you know, the point of that is that you don't necessarily need to rush on this, and you're not necessarily going to damage your child's eventual speech outcomes later on in life. So something I never mentioned to you is that I sent our book to Jack Paradise. And I don't know if I ever mentioned that to you.
No.
But, he's very noteworthy in our book. So I sent him a copy, and he sent me a lovely note as a thank you. He really enjoyed the book. So I wanted to let you know that. Yeah.
Oh, that's great to hear. Well, I mean, his study certainly has influenced this practice a lot. And I think the takeaway is there's absolutely an important role for ear tubes. But for parents who are hesitant initially, if they want to give it a try, the risks of delaying are not crucial, but you may very well still end up with ear tubes being necessary. Okay, let's move on to tonsillectomies. Now, tonsillectomies actually used to be maybe even more common than ear tubes, and actually, it was Jack Paradise's work as well that that led to a reduction in the use of tonsillectomies. They've certainly been much less common now, but they're still done all the time. Let's just start at the basic level. You know, why are tonsils problematic in some children, and why is there a need sometimes to take tonsils out?
Right. So tonsils, and when we talk about tonsils, we typically also talk about tonsils and adenoids too, which is a third set of tonsils behind the nose at the nasopharynx. And years ago, by that I mean, you know, before the 60s and 70s, if you had a sore throat or tonsillitis or strep throat, however you want to term it, and you had another strep throat, you would call your doctor and they would schedule you to get your tonsils out. And while they were at it, they would take out your siblings and the neighbors and your cousins. And it would just be a sort of literally a rite of passage that, you know, if you have a few sore throats, you get your tonsils out. And this was well before we were really looking at evidence-based medicine, especially for tonsils. So back in the day, we used to see a lot of children who would have recurrent strep throat or streptococcal tonsillitis, and the risks of post-strep glomerulonephritis or rheumatic fever related to tonsillitis was significant enough that you wouldn't necessarily want to wait it out. Now, then down the line, we realized that there was no good data to sort of support that. Once we had good quality antibiotics to treat streptococcal infections, there was no need to necessarily put a child through surgery, which is not without risk at all. That there are actually significant risks for that surgery.
And aren't tonsillectomies sometimes performed also for kids with snoring and sleep issues?
Right. So what happened is in the 70s and then later in the 80s, they stopped doing tonsillectomies. And it was really became sort of out of vogue that, you know, the rate of tonsillectomy dropped to probably 20% of what it had used to have been. And then we were starting to see, as pediatricians and as pediatric specialists, these children who would have snoring. And we didn't really know what to make of it. And then children would start to have sleep disorder breathing. And that became a whole new area of study in the 90s about, you know, children with sleep disordered breathing, and it was due to tonsils. And so we do see, I'd say, the majority of our patients who do get evaluated for tonsillectomy, and by a majority, I mean 90%+, it's now for sleep disordered breathing. So snoring, sleep apnea, and everything on the spectrum in between related to any sort of airway obstruction due to the tonsils. And most of these kids have never had strep throat, never had a sore throat, but their tonsils and adenoids have just grown throughout their early childhood.
So if you have a parent with a child who comes to you and there's some snoring and they're not sleeping well, they have some sleep apnea, what factors do you consider when deciding, is this is someone who really needs surgery, or maybe this is someone with a milder case that we can just give it a little time and see how it goes? What goes into that decision making?
So there's several aspects to that. So one is obviously the history, and I really try to tease out with the parents whether it's just snoring or irregular breathing or disrupted breathing or truly apnea. And we sort of go over what that means when a child has an apneic episode, and whether it's just noise that they're hearing and the child sleeps all night and wakes up very happy and has a great day every day, but they just hear some noise, or whether there is really sleep disruption and how that is impacting not only their night, but also their day. So first is the history, and then obviously is the exam. If they have very large tonsils and very large adenoids, that, you know, should fit with that scenario. And then not all the time, because it's really not feasible to get a sleep study on every child, but the gold standard is still to do an overnight sleep study or polysomnography on these kids. And that gives us a little more objective data on whether or not this is something we need to go ahead and talk about removing their tonsils and adenoids, or whether it's mild enough where it's something that we can just watchful waiting and, you know, have them come back in a few months and reassess how they're doing.
And what are the risks of a tonsillectomy or adenoidectomy procedure?
For tonsils and adenoids, it is also done under general anesthesia. The difference is they are intubated and they have an IV placed. And depending on their age and their history, medical history, as well as if they've had a sleep study, how severe that is, we make that determination in advance whether they're going to be done in the hospital and stay overnight, or whether they're going to be done in the surgery center and go home. So children under 3 years of age with other medical problems will usually be done in the hospital with an overnight stay, and the other children will be able to have the surgery and go home afterwards. The main risk of tonsil surgery and adenoid surgery is bleeding. The next main risk is bleeding, and the next main risk is bleeding. So this is the reason why pediatric otolaryngologists lose sleep, is because of post-tonsillectomy bleeding. And we do everything in our possible regimen and power to reduce those risks, whether it's the technique that we use or the way we do it, or everyone has their sort of styles to reduce that risk.
And it makes sense to proceed, you know, only in those who's have enough dysfunction from the adenoids, right? And you can tell that from the sleep study to justify the risks. But again, if you have a child who's not sleeping well, that's going to have its own set of complications that at a certain point are going to outweigh the risks of surgery. So it's a delicate balance, like all these decisions are. Okay. Although the criteria have become more stringent about who should get tonsillectomies and ear tubes because of the data we talked about and the pros and cons, there are still some who think that these surgeries are overdone. And, maybe I'll just say bluntly, there are some doctors who there's financial incentives that affect decisions and so forth. I guess I'll just start by asking, do you think that there's a major problem we have of overuse of these procedures?
I think, thankfully, less so recently. I think over the years, people do really understand that not every child who has a stuffy nose or a little bit of snoring or two or three sore throats needs a tonsillectomy. And I think for the most part, physicians are tuned into that. You know, certainly you can find, you know, I tend to be on the conservative side. And, you know, I'm sure if a patient sees me and I say they don't need surgery, they can probably find someone who will do the surgery. That's for sure. There's very little financial incentive to do a tonsillectomy. You know, we're not in the business for that. So it's not a cosmetic procedure anyway. So, I think people have really listened to the guidelines and moved away from doing a tonsillectomy on everybody who, you know, has tonsils. So, it's still one of the most common procedures. And I think that is because the data that we're now looking at is how sleep quality impacts a child's day. So what I like to discuss with parents is that for the most part, sleep is going to be half of their day. And you want that half to be really, really productive and fruitful, and you want them to get good quality sleep. And if they're not getting good quality sleep during that 10 to 12 hours of their sleep time, they're not going to have good quality during their 10 to 14 hours of being awake.
Yeah, well, I think any parent knows how important sleep is to their kids' behavior. It's like night and day when my kids get a good night's sleep. So I can only imagine what it's like if that happens night in and over again. To a child. Well, the last question I want to ask you, Nina, one thing my wife, when she was a pediatric resident and rotated with you, really appreciated was that you really did take the time to talk about the pros and the cons, and you did have a more conservative approach with your patients. What advice would you give to a parent who has a child that has some fluid behind the ears, recurrent ear infections, some snoring, any of these ENT type issues? What should they be looking for in a doctor, and what advice would you give them?
You know, I think it is a little bit of a feel for it even if it's not necessarily that long-term relationship, such as a pediatrician or an internist, where that you're going to be developing. I think that there has to be a relationship and a rapport developed. And I think that if you as a parent ever feel like you're being pushed in one way or the other, then, you know, that's not the right relationship. You know, certainly if your child is in danger, then you may get pushed by your doctor. You know, for instance, if they have a very, very horrible sleep study result where their oxygen is dropping and, you know, you as a surgeon are genuinely worried about this child and the parent is a little more reluctant to proceed, that's one situation, but that's pretty unusual. I think for the most part, it is a little bit more of a give and take. I always tell parents that if they have questions, they don't necessarily need to be answered that right then and there. You know, oftentimes doctors are rushed and families aren't really thinking straight and they're dealing with their children in the office at the same time. So I always encourage parents to say, you know, or ask the doctor, is there a good time that we can talk about this some more? And if the doctor says no, then I think you've answered your question, that's not the doctor for you. So, you know, you always, again, doctors don't always have that time to spend, you know, 30, 40, 60 minutes just, you know, schmoozing about tonsils and adenoids. But if you feel like you're not getting your questions answered, or if you have other questions, or if you want to go home and think about it, that's really a good relationship to develop. And it's good for the doctor too. I feel like sometimes in a busy office day, and I feel like a patient is feeling rushed or I'm feeling rushed, and they're, you know, if they have several children with them, you know, in the office where they're focusing on them, oftentimes I will tell them, why don't you go home and think about it? And, you know, just take a little time, take a little breath. We're not doing the surgery, you know, today. So, and then let's talk in a few days and we can go over things again. And I think, and for both of us, myself included, it's sort of a little bit of a decompression that we can really both think about, you know, the pros and cons, address their child's issues. And so you don't always necessarily have to come up with the answer at that moment. And I think a lot of people, when they go to a specialist, especially, they feel like I need to come up with an answer today before I leave the office. And I think really you do not. And I feel like more and more over the years, that's what I've been telling families is, we're not saying yes or no, but why don't you think about it? And why don't I think about it? and we'll come up with a plan together. And I think that's really the way to go.
Right. And there's this term called shared decision making that's gaining a lot of traction, which is, you know, balancing, you know, the patient's views with the doctor's guidance and coming up to a decision that's right. Because many of these decisions are gray. They're not as black and white. What about a second opinion? Is it ever appropriate for a patient to get a second opinion?
Always. I think that, and I encourage it, you know, I can, you know, sometimes sense that a patient's not so comfortable and, you know, sometimes I'll give them some colleagues that I trust and like that, you know, why don't you meet with this person? And people get funny about that because they feel that they're betraying you or they're, you know, cheating on you or something. And, you know, or if, you know, if I'm the second opinion or if I'm the third opinion, you know, they're like, don't tell the other doctors that I'm seeing you, like I'm going to call them out. And, you know, we're all friends, we're all colleagues, we all know each other. So it's all good. And, you know, sometimes, you know, other people will have better ideas or different ideas that I don't think it's something that should be dissuaded unless it's so clear cut and you're just so comfortable and you're ready to go and you're good to go. I encourage that. And, you know, I just want to make sure that people get information from good sources, and the second opinion should not be, you know, a Facebook friend group, with all due respect, or, you know, just sort of these anecdotal experiences. I think that they really need to, you know, to see another specialist and get an opinion that way. Sure.
Well, I always tell my patients, these are really big decisions, you know, your health and a procedure and pros and cons. And, you know, you wouldn't make a huge financial decision without getting a couple different perspectives. So it's actually okay to see what a couple different people have to say before making a decision like that. Well, Dr. Nina Shapiro, I so appreciate your joining us today. Again, ENT surgeon at UCLA, author most recently of the book Hype. Check it out on Amazon. If you did enjoy what you heard today and you found it engaging, please do search and subscribe to the Healthy Skeptic MD on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts and pass it along to friends and family who might also be interested. Have a good week, and we'll pick it up again next week.